Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Fanboy Smackdown.
Fanboy Smackdown.
Fanboy Smackdown.
Today we're going to be talking about some fan feedback that we've got. Well, I don't know if they're fans or not yet, but definitely some feedback that we've got, and introduce ourselves a little bit since we've been sorely lacking in actually introducing ourselves other than our names at this point.
Yep.
All right. What do you want to do to start this off? You want to do the feedback first? You want to?
I say we start with the feedback.
All right. Start with the feedback. All right, the first one we've got is from Josh, our good friend Josh. We know Josh, actually. And
what's up, Josh?
Hey, Josh. Let's see. It's about episode 1, the first episode that we did. He went out and listened to the first one and sent us an email. Yo, Tony. This is Josh. I've been listening to episode 1 of the SmackDown, and I must say, I think it's a lot more interesting than I first imagined. Well, that's good to know.
Because he knows us. He probably thought, how interesting could we possibly be?
Dude, these guys are going to talk about Star Wars. No kidding. That's what we always talk about. Yeah, so, all right. Some very good points were broached during the show, and I'd like to chime in and add my two credits.
Nice. Yeah, very clever. Credits.
I want to take this back for 1 second.
It's not clear.
The subject of this email is Star Wars. It had to be Star Wars, which is actually a play on the reference from Raiders.
Nice. I didn't even really
snakes.
Pick that
it
up.
It had to be snakes. Anyway.
A little Lucasfilm humor there. Very excellent.
Yep. I digress. Number 1, Jar Jar Binks. We knew that. I knew that was...
Well, everybody has something to say about Jar Jar Binks.
Then again, I really do have to agree with Tony. That was an interesting way to think of it, marketing and all, and he did have his role. However, I believe he went farther than he should have. The droids were a very different kind of funny, half so, I think, because they were thinking robots with flawed personalities. I think Jar Jar was a poorly executed attempt at attracting an even younger audience than they had, and that he could have worked if someone had been there to make sure he didn't make the movie a slapstick. That's comment number 1 about
Jar Jar. Fair comment.
Sure. Number 2. What's with all the hate for episode 2?
It sucked.
I mean, could we possibly delve a little bit further into that? I do have to agree personally that I think it should have covered more of the Clone Wars and that the jump between 2 and 3 should have been a lot smaller than it was. But overall, it wasn't that bad of a film. Well,
I respectfully disagree.
I do the same. My biggest problem with it, and I think I mentioned it in the first go around, was the love story.
Yeah,
I mean this was the part of the story that was supposed to focus on the love story and
well, it makes no secret
showing how they got together. I just didn't buy it. It
makes no secret that it's the center of the story, and it's poorly written and underdeveloped. Relationship between the two. I guess, let me put it this way. Anakin's adolescent love for her is totally believable. The teenage infatuation.
Yeah.
I totally buy that.
Sure.
Why she becomes interested by the second half of the movie is beyond me.
Yeah.
And I don't believe it.
Why someone that mature and that adult, even for her young age, why she was even courting the notion, so to speak, it just didn't fly. So, Josh, that's
there you go,
that's
buddy.
The hate. That's the hate. The hate is about the love. Okay, point number 3. I feel I should chime in here on the argument about Anakin and whether or not he is in fact the chosen one. Unfortunately, to do so, I must present facts from both the EU and the movie canon. So this will go in 2 parts. So now we have part 3, number 3, part A.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Expanded universe. If you look long and hard here, you see a subliminal message that I think Lucas didn't intend when he did 4, 5, and 6, but definitely was going with when he started the new trilogy. You see, when the original trilogy came out, you didn't have the thousands of novels, games, and whatnot that he's sort of going along with the EU canon more and more. But now he's sort of going along with the EU canon more and more. Let's see, continuing on. If you look at it, Anakin was the chosen one in the EU canon because he eliminated the Jedi, who were too weak and never would evolve. It is stated that Yoda had spent time on the Council fighting to keep the Jedi's old ways, the peace, justice, and harmony stuff, and that he was resisting change. Now, if we fast forward a few decades, you can see that as a result of Anakin purging the Jedi, we have Luke's Academy along with several other Jedi Masters, such as Kip Duran, and God help me with the fanboys if I start pronouncing some of these names wrong.
Well, you're going to get smacked down, because that's the point of this podcast.
That's fine.
Smack them down.
We smack back. So
smack,
that's
down the, smack down the fanboys who disagree with your pronunciation of the name.
All right. Since Kip Duran, who have managed to understand that there isn't just a light and dark side, but also a gray side of the Force. It was with this new training and new mindset that the Jedi were able to defeat the... Okay, Yuuzhan Vong invaders, who had the New Republic crippled beyond their ability to win. Had it not been for the actions of Anakin, the Vong would control the galaxy, and they would be an enemy much fiercer than the Empire ever was. Haven't really delved into the expanded universe. I can't speak a whole lot to it.
That's an argument that can be made, but not in the context of the podcast we did, where we decided that the canon was going to be just the six films.
Sure.
And, I mean, if Lucas is drawing more on the expanded universe, then that certainly... Josh would know about that, and he probably could make a strong case for what he's saying. I don't know about it, so I can't.
Really. All right, Josh, let's hear your expanded universe podcast.
Bring it on, man.
And you're welcome to join us. You know how to get a hold of us.
That would be cool.
Feel free to give us more info.
The bat phone is ringing.
One more time, we've got a phone call. All right. Podcasting.
Commissioner Gordon.
All right. Part B. You want to take this, or we good? Okay. Part B. Unfortunately, I don't have much of an argument without quoting the EU, but I do side with Tony in that... Tony. Me, I guess.
Yeah.
It's saying that he brought balance to the Force because at the end of Episode 3 there were two Jedi and two Sith, not to mention the Order was wrong in many of its ways. They were not attuned to the living Force that Qui-Gon mentioned. They were too much like Zealots and not enough like Druids, so to speak. Alternately, you could look at it like this. It wasn't really Anakin that caused the Order to die. If Palpatine had not exposed himself to Anakin and the Order never found out, he would have remained in secrecy, and the Order 66 would have killed the Jedi Order anyway. Thus, Anakin brings balance to the Force at the end of Episode 6 when he destroys the Emperor, thus proving that he is in fact the Chosen One. If he had never been there because he had died in the Jedi Purge, the Empire would have won the Battle of Endor.
I mean, I don't really disagree with that. No way.
The question, there's a lot you could go into in that. Would someone else have been as merciful with Leia in Episode 4? The one question that I always had in watching Episode 4 was, why did he spare her? I mean, this guy's been pretty ruthless with people on his own team. You know, he kills admirals. I think there was something there. I think there was something there. There was no reason to keep her alive. Once they destroyed Alderaan. What purpose was there to keep her alive?
I don't know.
Unless there was some subconscious.
Well, if I could remember correctly, she still knew where the rebel base was. And destroying Alderaan wasn't going to change that. Alderaan happened to be where one of the rebel bases was, I believe, if my memory serves me correctly. But she told them it was on Dantooine.
Well, they threatened to destroy Alderaan. She said, it's on Dantooine. Well, they said, fine. We're going to destroy Alderaan anyway.
Right.
Because Dantooine's far too remote. It wouldn't make a good show of power. It wasn't as pretty a target. It wasn't going to catch the media attention.
But then when Dantooine was not the actual base, they did make the choice of Terminator. But then by then, Luke and Han Solo had infiltrated the Death Star.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think...
And maybe they were going to make more of a public spectacle. I mean, you can go in a million different ways with this.
I think the bottom line is, for me, Anakin... The conclusion I drew from it after having seen the films was that Anakin was not the one, but that the unintended consequences of what's the Darth that Sidious killed, the one who could create life? Sidious was the apprentice of the one that could create life.
Yeah, I'm not recalling it off the top of my
head. And basically, that person created a person that was so powerful, everyone thought he was the one, but the unintended consequences of that evil was that the one actually was born, and that the one was Luke. At least that's what I got from it. And that the unintended consequences of that evil was that the prophecy was fulfilled, even though the dark side of the Force could not see that would happen. At least that's what I got from it.
Right. I'm still disagreeing with you that...
Yeah, I know.
That's okay. We're bound to disagree. Let's see. Also, going back to the EU for a moment, if the Empire had won the Battle of Endor, the Vong would have crushed them as well, in my opinion. Either way you look at it, the Vong would be in control of all the galaxy and Star Wars would end. That's about all I have for the moment, but I'll be sure to pipe in on stuff I hear on the show. Favorite episodes from worst to best.
That's okay, cool, yeah.
What we asked him to do. Now, this is interesting. Worst to best. 1, 4, 2, 3, 5, 6. So, he's saying that Return of the Jedi is best. Before that, Empire. Before that, Revenge of the Sith. Now he asks us why the hate for Episode 2. Yet, he has it in his bottom half.
Well... But I mean, 3 was in my bottom half, but I still thought it was a really strong movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the only two I thought were weak were Return of the Jedi and Episode 2. So, I mean, the first 4 on my list were pretty high, actually. So I could see how he could like it enough.
Sure. We have one PS. You fanboys need to knock off the Star Wars. This show needs more Final Fantasy VII. That's his personal fanboy moment as he's in there.
Right.
Fanboy, we'd have to see Final Fantasy VII.
I don't know.
Comment on it.
I don't know anything about Final Fantasy. I mean, it's a video game. I know that.
Yeah.
You know.
I saw the first Final Fantasy movie. I played the first Final Fantasy game.
Like, I remember when that came
out. When it was just called Final Fantasy for the NES, the original Nintendo. It was a side scroller.
I'll tell you what I like, man.
What I think is funny is how you have a game called Final Fantasy, and they're at what, like part 11 or 12 now.
Yeah,
that's hilarious to me. But
man, when Final Fantasy came out, there was another game called Dragon Warrior that came out for NES. Mm-hmm. I loved that game. That was a great game.
I actually remember finishing Final Fantasy. That was a highlight of my young life at the time. How pathetic is that? All right, I guess... Fanboy moment. All right, on to episode 2 and our second fan comment. And this is from Steve Williams. We've heard quite a bit from Steve, and we'll read the first email that he sent. We're going to play a voice comment here right after that, and then we'll go back and read the... Well, we've got another one from Josh also.
Right.
And then we'll go back to another one from Steve. So we got a couple more comments to go through here. Hi, Tony. I just happened to stumble onto your podcast this morning. Your Fanboy Smackdown moniker put me off a little. Fearful that it might be one of those, I give you props, dog, podcast. Glad
which
it
we
isn't.
Did later.
Which we did. Which we did in the last episode. Steve, that was for you. It was completely in jest. And thank Killian's and Bourbon for that.
That's right.
All right. Steve goes on to say, I'm about the same age as George Lucas and from California, so it's quite easy for me to relate to his films. I was in the Air Force during the Vietnam War days when George made THX-1138-4EB at USC. It was considered to be first a student film, and later, in the 60s, an underground film. He says that he used to attend screenings of underground films in East Hollywood while he was a college student on the GI Bill
cool.
in the late 60s, and remember seeing this one night. When THX minus the 4EB was screened in the 70s, my World War II baby and early boomers generation absolutely loved it, but no one else did, so it bombed. American Graffiti was liked almost as much, but being Los Angeles kids, we considered teenagers from the San Joaquin Valley to be just a bunch of hicks.
I like that.
10 years behind us culturally, that got married at 18 because they had nothing better to do.
Well, they were just driving around in cars all the time,
well, yeah.
according to the film.
Sure.
So his letter holds
there?
Up.
What more was there to do? The movie featured a real rock and roll soundtrack instead of that typical American international beach party-ish junk, a real first. Star Wars was absolutely wonderful. It alluded to so many films I'm sure George Lucas was exposed to in his film school days, but talking to the dudes and dudettes of today about how Darth Vader's costume is basically a 17th century Japanese, they either give you a blank look or get angry.
They get angry, I guess, huh?
The same with speaking of Darth's stormtroopers alluding to the faceless, dehumanized German troops in Eisenstein's and Alexander Nevsky, which we're going to talk about in just a moment.
Right.
As a matter of fact, a lot of Star Wars was lifted from this Russian film, but don't tell the dudes. The more intelligent ones might ask, who is this Eisenstein dude? Which we did. We did ask the question. Because neither of us were familiar directly with the film. Let me go ahead and finish this, and we'll jump into Nevsky. I remember speaking to a Gen Y guy about Count Dooku, played by Christopher Lee, alluding to Count Dracula. Christopher Lee. He got a blank look. Yoda is a yogi. A Jedi is a samurai. More blank looks. The Vietnam War started by our Texas president with fake evidence is similar to the Iraq War. No, it isn't, replied the Gen Y. Most Gen Ys aren't stupid, but they're generally not known for their deep thinking and seem like at times to be willfully ignorant, very much like my generation's parents. I'm sorry, I seem to be going on, and I have a podcast to do. Steve is also a fellow podcaster. I think your podcast is right on the money, put together with a lot of thought, and I'm looking forward to episode 3. Steve Williams. Steve does the Cine Snob Telepod. I've listened to a couple of his of episodes of the Cine Snob Telepod. It's a good show. It's really good. He does reviews of movies that are kind of out of the mainstream. They're out on DVD, but they're out of the mainstream. Some of them I've heard of before. Quite a few of them I had not. And he gave us his suggestion for Alexander Nevsky.
And we took the challenge.
Absolutely.
We took the Cine Snob challenge.
Absolutely. It's, I think that's something that we can do. If people give us suggestions for films we should look at, within reason, they don't send us 80 films to see.
Right.
We're going to check them out. We'll take a look at them.
Well, it's interesting to have, definitely a dialogue about the topics that we want to bring up, with people who are listening. And
oh,
so
yeah.
To watch Alexander Nevsky and how it relates to everything we've been talking about is definitely a cool thing to do, and we appreciate the suggestion.
Yeah, it was a really interesting film, and the points that Steve made regarding the faceless stormtroopers and the German soldiers were right on.
Yes,
I mean you really didn't see the German soldiers.
But I there's one thing that's interesting to me about this. It's kind of a chicken or the egg thing. Star Wars made in the 70s.
Sure.
Nevsky was made in 1938 when the German SS some of who were called brown shirts, and some of who I believe were actually called stormtroopers. I could have my history wrong, but I think that's correct. Were doing their business. So the question is, was Lucas's stormtroopers influenced by Nevsky's version of the German stormtroopers, or was Lucas's stormtroopers based on the Nazi stormtroopers, of which Nevsky's Teutonic Knights were also based?
That's true. That's a good point. You make a good point there. Another thing to add to that, and I think Steve points this out at another point, the peasant garb of some of the characters in this looked suspiciously like the Jedi robes.
Correct. And the ladies had the twin braids.
Yes.
Very Leia-like.
Yes.
And then there was also the Cyrillic that we were trying to decipher.
Yeah.
At the end of each phrasing, where they go to a new location, it would be the city of Novgorod or something else. The last phrase would be in Cyrillic, what looks to us in Roman alphabet to be O3EPO. And whether Lucas had any intentions to reference whatever that phrase means in Cyrillic remains in doubt, but it was very interesting to see.
I didn't notice it until you pointed out this evening. I thought that was a pretty cool catch. You know, a few other things that I don't think we mentioned at the time, as far as just how influenced George Lucas was by things before with Star Wars. One of the big things that I noticed when I went back and looked at the Flash Gordon serials from the 30s. They begin every episode of the serial with an oddly familiar scrolling text that scrolls and gets smaller to a point as it goes into the background, and that's how each episode begins, giving you a preview of what came before. And I remember seeing that, it was sometime in the 80s, and watching this videotape of this and just jumping up and down on my bed going, oh my god, that's where that came from. I mean, you know that nothing's new, but it's kind of cool to see it for the first time and actually get the feel for it.
Yeah, Star Wars, at least the earliest films, and even to a certain extent, I think the newer ones are based more on overture-type films of the Nevsky, you know, which actually, on the subject of films being more classical compositions in terms of how the music is worked into the film and how it's kind of a symmetrical storyline for like an overture and then a second part and then a third part movements, if you will.
Right.
The films mirror really classical overtures, kind of like theater did back when theater and classical music were so closely intertwined.
Yeah.
And Prokofiev did the music for Nevsky.
Okay.
And that blew me away. And then when I listened to the music, until then, I was very conscious of the music in the film at that point when I saw the credits that Prokofiev did the music. And it is totally ahead of its time, man. It's just a lot of the pieces seem to me to have elements of atonality in them, which I guess for the modernist period maybe was not totally ahead of its time, but I mean, it's Russian classical. I mean, it's, you know, it's still far out for the genre it's supposed to be in.
Okay, music fanboy.
All right, yeah, well, that's right. I like music.
That's okay.
Just thought I would make some comments.
That's cool. Because that is something that I absolutely cannot speak to.
I don't know much about Prokofiev. He was mentioned in We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel, and that's when I first heard about him. Other than that, I don't really know. I just know he's a composer, and he's fairly good at what he does, or did.
Yeah. So. All right. Ready to go on to our audio comment, then?
Sure.
All right, let's go on to that. We're going to take just a second here and cue up the audio comment, and we will be right back after that.
Hi, guys. It's your #1 fan with a bullet, Steve Williams from CineSnob.com. In your discussion about the Batman movies, you admitted the motion picture that started it all. The Batman, a 259-minute movie serial released in 1943. Now, in that picture, Batman, played by Lewis Wilson, fought various Jap spies that infested California during our War on Terror. The arch-villain of the mall was Dr. Daka, whose raison d'etre was to shoot red-blooded Americans with a radium gun and turn them into zombies for the Japanese Empire. About 22 years later, during the Andy Warhol pop art period, it was re-released as a two-part camp motion picture, something like an early Reefer Madness, and it was a huge success among those of us born in the 1940s. Even among some of my Japanese-American friends, born in various World War II relocation camps, thought Batman's racist attitude bordered on dementia. Anyway, this film led to a very popular camp TV series and the disappointing 1966 movie, which, along with the Vietnam War, killed the 1960s franchise. Of course, we had to wait until another generation had passed, until the Tim Burton, Michael Keaton masterpiece hit the screens. Anyway, look forward to more of your movie podcasts. Take care, guys.
Thanks, Steve. That was very cool. So we got our first audio comment. Steve, though, did not use the Fanboy SmackDown number that everybody has access to. That was something that he actually cut as an MP3 file and emailed to us.
Cool.
Which you are more than welcome to do. Email it to fanboysmackdown@gmail.com. You can email us a MP3 and we can play it as an audio comment. Or you can give us a call, 206-339-FBSD. We'll give that number again toward the end. But that was very cool comments. And he's right. We missed it.
Yeah, I mean...
We didn't talk a whole lot about the later three movies in that second set of theatrical run, the post Tim Burton Batman run of movies. I didn't really feel the need to talk about those.
Me neither. I think the interesting thing about his comments is how the Batman films. Or TV show, rather, serials, had to be campy and lighthearted in a sense to offset the demented Batman of the 1940s, which people, absorbed when it was re-released.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, if you look at the technology that was available in the 40s, when Batman really started going as a comic book, this guy had to have been nuts.
he did,
it's not like he's got Kevlar body armor, he doesn't have grapple guns and things like that. I know they included a lot of that stuff, but those were fantasy objects. I mean, they were more the stuff of science fiction, a lot of the stuff that was going on in that book, than reality, which,
right.
Batman Begins, they really strove for modern technology.
Right.
That's why the Batmobile looked as ugly as it did. Because they wanted something that, when built, would do what was required of them. Was required of the vehicle. And that vehicle could do what was advertised.
The Batman Begins has the benefit of being made in a period of modern technology.
Absolutely.
The earlier films... don't have that benefit, and perhaps that's why they suffer. But I think Batman, the serials, suffered anyway from a kind of, if you can't beat them, join them attitude toward psychedelia
Are you talking the cultural, about the TV series?
Yeah.
Yeah, the TV series.
It's a cultural place, and it's very interesting. He really, Steve being who I'm talking about, really puts into perspective why Batman has evolved culturally the way he has.
Absolutely.
And that, 1966 was the Batman movie?
Yes, yes.
Okay, Blonde on Blonde, Sergeant Pepper was in 67.
Yep.
That was the height of psychedelia.
Sure.
And that was the... And it was a. It was definitely a kind of...
You had bat shark repellent.
Yeah, carefree, kind of bright... And kind of, if you can't beat them, join them, trying to stay hip with what was culturally, as he put it, you know, an opposition. It's a counterculture movement.
Sure.
And Batman, not that the Batman series was actually counterculture, but that it was drawing on some kind of design to I guess, fit in, sort of, in a safe way with what was going on at the time.
Sure.
So now it looks really dated.
Oh, yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. So. And you know, another thing that's great about Steve's comments is he gives us a generational perspective.
Exactly.
that we don't have. You know, we're fairly close in age. We've only got a 10-year difference, and Steve gives us an even larger gap to expand on. And he's a film guy, so we get some really cool references to things that may just be out of our, you know, our immediate line of focus because we weren't, you know, we didn't have those references growing up, or we just neglected them for whatever reason. So thanks, Steve. That was another great kind
of. I'm born 4 days before. Otherwise, I would have become a member of Generation Y. So I'm so thankful that I'm still the Gen X crowd.
Yeah,
and
You just barely made the cut. All right. We have another comment about our third podcast from Josh. Hey, I wanted to give some feedback on episode 3 and my personal take on the Batman movies. Now, it struck me as unfair to comment on this podcast, seeing as I've seen Batman Begins recently but had not seen Tim Burton's Batman in several years and had nearly forgotten it entirely. So I decided to pop it in and watch it before I reviewed. Now, you know, for everybody else's benefit, I saw Josh earlier today, told him we were going to be doing our review show, our feedback show, and said if he had, you know, this was a shot to get in a little more commentary. So he took up the challenge.
So he sent us 15 letters.
Yes.
No, I'm just kidding.
No, we just got the one. But he is verbose.
In a good way.
Yeah.
He's a writer, you know.
Absolutely. Let's see. Like to make some points in no particular order. First, about Gotham. In Tim Burton's Batman, the setting could be called gritty and grim, but I think one of the large differences would be the hopelessness that it is presented in Batman Begins. The way I see things, life in Tim Burton's Gotham could be mediocre, but it doesn't appear all that bad if you look at it. Sure, there is crime, but it's more like an entire city filled with the worst of New York than its own personal flair for wickedness. What I mean by this is evident in Batman Begins, where it appears as though the common people have no representative. They have no help. Gordon is one and few, he's outnumbered, and has no one behind him. This is a truly grim and gritty Gotham City, as opposed to Tim Burton's, where I can honestly say that things don't look all that bad.
I would have to disagree, and here's why. Detective Eckhart is one of the head detectives. He's totally corrupt in the pocket of the mob, who also runs the city. It's not a whole lot different from the Carmine gang running the city and most of the cops, except for Gordon, being totally corrupt.
Right.
I don't really see much of a difference there. As far as the aesthetic element, I would have to actually say Burton's is darker.
It's darker, and it takes more of a dark fantasy approach to it. Yeah, just in the
kind of a 1930s retro future, if you will.
Exactly,
a noirish kind of American Gothic piece, really.
Yeah, it was almost like that went through everything in Burton's movie too. From the vehicles to the cityscape. I mean, it was all over.
Yep.
I mean, he had things where they looked like they were circa 1930 and circa 1980 right next to each other.
Interesting to me is the Batman Begins city is a modern city, but the choices in terms of how modern and how fast-paced, perhaps the way people feel they are treated, and in the musical choices, suggests to me a lot the Blade Runner cityscape. Absolutely. Just not as forward-looking.
Sure. Okay, let's go ahead and move on to our next part of Josh's comment. Batman. Maybe it's just me, but Michael Keaton is too stiff. He also played a less believable Bruce, with no visible goals nor clearly evident motivation. He was too quiet and not charismatic enough for me. Christian Bale played a more realistic, down-to-earth Batman. You also have a character more rooted in truth. He gets screwed over more, and he sustains much more visible injury when he's starting his career in crime-fighting. He is flawed, and his flaws extend beyond just being less than perfect. At first, he quarrels with his moral dilemma, then he's forced to make a decision. One thing I noticed immediately was the age difference. It may be just because of my age, but I have to say that the first half hour of the movie felt like the first half hour of nearly any movie made during the 80s, with the occasional difference here and there. It also trailed badly. It could have been a half an hour less, but that wouldn't help it enough, as it would have just been paced better.
See, okay, I agree with his point about Christian Bale being a better Batman, although I don't think Michael Keaton had a lot to work with in the sense that it was the Joker's film, and basically all he was doing was being the Bruce Wayne who was already comfortable in the skin of being Batman and didn't really need to develop anything except room in his life for a girl like Kim Basinger.
Right.
Whereas Christian Bale had to go through all of that, which made for a better story, and that's ultimately why I think the second film is better.
Yeah.
But I don't think Michael Keaton had a lot to work with. The other thing I would disagree with is that I like the pacing of older films.
Right.
I think it comes from, I think viewers today are less patient.
Absolutely.
Because, and we've talked about this before.
Sure, oh yeah.
On past podcasts as well, that the pacing of Batman is like the pacing of other films in the 80s, but that doesn't mean it doesn't work. It is highly interesting to me. It takes time to establish the relationship between Commissioner Gordon, Harvey Dent, Alfred and Batman, and Knox, who is a very, if not vital character to the film, gives it a lot of life. If Knox's character wasn't in the first half hour as prominent as he was, what kind of story would you have with regards to the press element, him trying to figure out what's going on in the city? Knox really is a voice for setting up the whole story.
Right.
So I would kind of have to disagree with that, but I understand where Josh is coming from on the Bruce Wayne thing.
Well, and another thing that I'd like to add about the Keaton Bruce Wayne, forgive the noise in the background, during one of our pauses, the family got home and the little guy's banging around upstairs trying to go to bed.
What all little guys like to do.
Yeah, trying to fight it.
I was there.
Fighting it hard. But I was saying about Keaton's Batman and Keaton's Bruce Wayne, I really enjoyed Keaton's Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
Because, and my take on it, and I can understand why Josh would say he's stiff. But I would also challenge you to watch him. He's distracted. He's not there. He's there at the party. He's there physically, but his mind is elsewhere. This is not his primary focus. And it's evident. I think Michael Keaton plays that well, plays distracted very well.
And Bale is a more youthful Batman. He's got a lot of fire in him.
Yes.
Keaton, as an older Batman, and Keaton's style in general, Keaton comes out of a comedy background. The sly drollness, it's Japanese.
Yes.
Why? How do you know that? Because I bought it in Japan.
Right.
Oh, I'm Bruce Wayne. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's part of his delivery. I think that you might like the personality, you might not like it. I don't know if there was a lot he could do to change that. It's one of the things that made him the actor that he was.
Well, you're talking about a character in two different stages of his life. The way I looked at Bale's Batman, he's still figuring out who he is. Is he Batman? Is he Bruce Wayne? can the two be mutually exclusive? Does he have to choose one?
And that's why it's so compelling.
And I think that, yeah, it makes for a compelling film. And that theme was in the first couple of Batman movies that Tim Burton and Michael Keaton did. I think the difference is that Keaton had already made his choice by then. You know, the Bruce Wayne of that at that point, later on in his career, had already made his choice. You know, assuming that you know, you're using the same timeline.
And also, I mean, Keaton has to share the screen with Jack Nicholson in that film.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's very difficult to appear less stiff than Jack Nicholson.
Oh, yeah.
So, I think it's all relative.
Absolutely. But. Absolutely. All right, moving on. Also, they were done differently. Tim Burton's movie was a ride. Batman Begins was a story. In Tim Burton's, you start off as the viewer. There's a bad guy talking about a mythical bat creature. The tabloids are buzzing. Then the girl meets with rich, stoic man named Bruce Wayne. In Batman Begins, you start off almost immediately following Bruce, seeing what made him, his emotional trauma, which is a flashback in the other movie, and his journey to become a man. I understand your points, but it's basic. I mean, I look at that as two different methods of storytelling, and again, you're talking about someone in two different parts of their life. You're talking about Batman Begins, which is an origin story. You are following him through how he became Batman, as opposed to the Batman movie, which is basically one of his adventures.
I do see the point, though, that it is more of a ride.
Oh, yeah.
Than Begins, which is story-driven, which is why Begins is more interesting to me personally.
I would actually disagree with it, and I would say that Begins is more character driven, and Batman is more story driven, and that's what gives it the aspect of being a ride. You have to pay attention to Batman. Begins
is more character driven, but I think it's also more story driven. It's a very complex plot at work.
Yeah, but the characters are still driving it as much as anything.
I agree with that. Yeah, it's a character-driven film.
I mean, you have the hook, the Ra's al Ghul, that overarching story.
Spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler. Whatever. We spoiled it before if we didn't already.
If you haven't listened to the first four episodes and you're just tuning in, Ra's al Ghul's the main villain in Batman Begins.
No, it's the Scarecrow. Yeah, I mean, I looked at that as more to drive the character, but that's just how I looked at it. Let's see. My main complaint about Batman Begins is the lackluster feel of the action. The quick cuts and hasty scenes were mentioned, but I don't think in great enough detail. I wanted to vomit during the final fight against Ra's al Ghul because things were flashing so quickly. I would have paid money to watch that fight from a side view. You paid money to see that view the way it was. Sorry. Little commentary there. I would have paid money to watch that fight from
the side
view. I guess
he's saying that...
with a camera that didn't move like that.
He's saying that the film work made him queasy, not that it was so bad that he wanted to vomit.
I think it was the way that it was shot. Let's see.
Made him physically queasy.
Yeah, let me go ahead and finish this a little bit here, but I think it's because Batman Begins is a victim of too much story and not enough action or special effects. I guess they didn't bother to go through combat training or something. I would take exception to that. I think it was a calculated move on their part to shoot it that way. Not to hide anything, but... And I mentioned this before. I think it gave you more of the anxiety and the fury of being involved in an attack by someone that is that skilled.
I agree.
And it gives you the sense of what it must be like for someone facing a guy in a bat suit, which doesn't seem, you know, to a logical, rational mind, doesn't seem like that big a deal until you see him move.
The film makes very clear in the beginning, theatricality and deception, blah, blah, blah. You must become more than a man in the mind of your opponent. Following scenes after the Asian sequence, you experience everything from the perspective of being hunted by Batman rather than how you perceive it in the training, which is being Christian Bale. You're Christian Bale and you're being assaulted by Liam Neeson. And then after that point in the rest of the film, you are the attacked.
Yes.
Being assaulted by Batman. And
I think
it's very effective.
I think that's great.
I think that's one of the best films I've ever seen. Let me put it this way. It's one of the best films I've seen in theaters in forever. I can't remember the last time I've seen a film that good. I went to see it 4 times. Maybe I'm revealing how much of a nerd I am.
Wow.
I went to see it 4 times.
I've seen it twice, and that's because my wife wanted to see it once, and we watched it at home on DVD.
I went myself. Oh, no, I went with my girlfriend who fell asleep, incidentally.
Nothing like calling out the girlfriend.
Sorry, Kieran. Anyway, love you. Anyway, she won't deny it. She thinks it's a bad movie. And then I went and saw it with Mark, who I had to take Mark to see it. He liked it. He didn't even care about Batman. And he came out thinking, what a great movie. Mm-hmm. Then I took my brother, who loved the Tim Burton original, and we had him on, and he was really disappointed coming out of it.
Yeah.
And then I had to see it one more time for myself before I left the theaters, because it was just on the big screen, man, and it's just...
Yep.
Oh, it's a great film. I just can't remember the last time I enjoyed a movie that much. So, good story.
All right. Let's go ahead and wrap up.
Sorry, Karen.
What Josh has going here. Then again, I noticed that I liked the character interaction between Alfred and Bruce more in Tim Burton's. But as I was thinking about it, I didn't like it so much because it was better than in Batman Begins, because there was more of it in the first movie. Merely scenes where Alfred follows Bruce around picking up his cigar and his drink, little things that I don't remember from Batman Begins. I'm sure there's more, but that's all I can think of for now. And it's already 8 o'clock. He knew we were doing this at 8.
On the Alfred thing, it's another thing where Bruce is in two different places. Alfred is a mentor to Bruce in Batman Begins. Alfred is the butler to a grown man who knows who he is in the original Batman.
Right.
And, you know, maybe in the next Batman we will see Alfred taking on more of a butlery role. I mean, but he is both mentor and...
he's a father figure.
Yeah.
He is a father figure. And they make... I mean, that's very obvious. The father figure aspect that Alfred plays in Batman Begins. I think the
and it's Alfred, played up in Batman too to a certain extent.
It is.
There's a big conversation where he's like, Alfred is my family, and Alfred talks about raising him, and it works. They both work well, I think, in that sense.
Yes. I think another thing that is the difference there goes to how they portray Bruce Wayne's Batman, or Michael Keaton's Bruce Wayne in Batman, that he plays him so distracted. His mind is somewhere else. He is Batman all the time and is playing the role of Bruce Wayne. And Alfred knows that. I mean, Alfred is working with that. He knows the man that he works for, he knows his weakness. He knows that he has to help him maintain this cover, this act, and he's following that, picking up the cigars out of the planter and different, you know, goofy things like that. I mean, it's just, you know, it's the role that he's playing. So,
but great letter from Josh. We really appreciate
it. Yes, thank you.
Well thought out, and I mean, hey, we appreciate anybody who takes the time to listen to our podcast and argue us point for point. That's what the podcast is about.
Absolutely.
And we really enjoy the letters we get. So keep writing and keep giving us a call.
Yes, and again, thanks, Josh. Okay, we've got the last bit of feedback here. This is another one from our good buddy Steve. This was following the Da Vinci Code podcast that we did last time.
I don't know if I've read this one. Have I read this one?
I don't know. Have you? I thought I forwarded it to you.
Okay,
anyway,
I don't know.
If not, this is going to be cold.
Excellent.
And
I can't remember.
You'll be getting fresh commentary from Tony. All right. Hi, Tonys. I'm subscribing through blah, blah, blah. A little more technical stuff. I'm subscribing through the Doppelganger the Doppler aggregator as opposed to iTunes or another way of doing it. I noticed that we have a number of people who are just downloading
right
from the web, and that's cool. However you want to do it, if you want to download the episodes individually, you can do that. If you need a little bit of help with iTunes or with another aggregator, feel free to give us an email, and we will help walk you through it. If we have call for it, we'll set up some of those one-click buttons right on the website.
We'll hook you up, dog.
And we'll give you props at the same time.
And we'll give you props after hooking you up, dog.
All right. Let's see. I'm subscribing through the Doppler aggregator. So your DaVinci Code podcast found its way to the Mojave Desert last night. He goes on to say, I'm a left-wing WASP Protestant born in 44 in Los Angeles, and my wife is a conservative Italian Catholic, also born in L.A., almost the same age as Ron Howard. We're both second-generation Californians who lost our war veteran fathers last year, and we both read the book. I thought it was the best motion picture that Mr. Howard has ever directed, which is, I suppose, a backhanded compliment to his lightweight directing skills. He says his wife didn't care much for it, but likes Howard's directing a lot more than Steve does. Strictly visceral opinions. As in your St. Louis theater, there was no protesting or catcalls at our Beach City theater. They took in a Sunday afternoon show, I guess, that opening weekend. Anyway, found podcast number 4 to be excellent as usual. Thank you. Even with the "Hello, St. Louis, are you ready for rock band" in the background? Yeah. We had that going for us there. We were podcasting from a bar. We are not podcasting from a bar.
I remember this
tonight.
Letter now. He said it was the Gorilla Podcast. Yes, the Gorilla Podcasting.
We are not podcasting from a bar tonight. We're podcasting from...
It's not that we're not drinking. We're just not podcasting
at
a bar.
We are drinking. We're just not podcasting from a bar. the women you interviewed outside the theater were a little hard to understand, but I caught about 70 to 90% of what they were saying. Interesting concept and one that makes sense. Gorilla podcasting outside a theater in a nearby cocktail lounge. Don't think I ever heard a movie podcast attempt that before. And we may attempt it again, you know. And maybe, I think the big difference is we just try to find someplace a little more quiet next time.
Yeah. It was a sports bar. It's one of those atmospheres. Not that I didn't enjoy it.
They
have a great jukebox there, by the way.
They did. Thank you, Axel. had a nice little bit of background music there. Please don't sue us. he goes on to say that he's not doing his Friday show this week, so he gave us a shout out. He said I had sent him an email earlier telling him we were checking out Nevsky, and here's another point. He says, you're going to suddenly discover where Luke Skywalker got his peasant costume and encounter a tough, vivacious Princess Leia type that has two friends vying for her hand in marriage.
Yep. It's all there.
Yeah, and another thing, and I don't know that I mentioned this, but the action sequence seem as if they belong 30 years in the future.
Yeah, exactly. The technical directing in terms
incredible.
Of the battles was, yeah, very progressive.
It was, I mean... The length and the depth of the action sequences was like something you watched today.
I particularly enjoyed the scene where in phalanx style, which I would have to believe if I remember correctly is the way exactly they fought. Like
sure.
He probably even the director Eisenstein probably even had to study military tactics to understand how they fought. They would fire their arrows, and they would stand lined up phalanx style, all
yep.
shields. Could not break through the barrier. And then, once they fired enough arrows, and they tried to charge the shields, and they couldn't, and they retreated to a certain extent, all the shields open up simultaneously, and the infantry, if you will, come crawling out, you know, single file, and attack, you know, the opponents one on one.
Absolutely.
And it was it's exactly how I would imagine a battle in the 13th century being conducted. Like, I don't know anything about military tactics. I listen to the Pritzker Military Library podcast, but that's about it. So.
Sure.
But it was very fascinating to me.
Yeah, yeah. The battle sequences in that Nevsky were really, really something to watch. Really reminiscent of the modern war movies in the scope. I mean, you know, we're talking things like Braveheart and Gladiator and Lord of the Rings.
Right.
The battle sequences in those movies, they were, you know, while not technically special effects wise in the same scope, they were really, really able to be compared there.
For more information on this or other episodes, log on to www.fanboysmackdown.com.